It's The Wonky Show. OFS has published its first Equality of Opportunity Risk Register for English HE, but are there some big risks missing? UCAS says we'll soon have 1 million applicants, we'll work out what that means. Wales is working towards better mental health, and Turnitin is turning on AI detection, but plenty of people want to turn it off. It's all coming up.
These 18-year-olds, even if they don't go to university, they still have to live somewhere, okay, right? So, like, they live in university halls, maybe, or, you know, they live at home, but, like, there's a broader issue here about how we're going to house people beyond higher education, because they need somewhere to live.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and joining me, crawling our way to the Easter break as usual, three behemoths of HE policy. In High Holborn, James Purnell is Vice Chancellor at the University of the Arts London. James, your highlight of the week, please.
I think honestly it's going to be getting to the end of the week because I'm on holiday from tomorrow, but maybe more professionally, it was taking our online approach to our court this week and hearing my DVC education and my chief digital officer finishing each other's sentences. And if you're going to do a big online thing, as I learned to the BBC, you have to have both sides working in partnership. And it was lovely.
Excellent stuff. And in Colchester this morning, Anne-Marie Canning is CEO at the Brilliant Club. Anne-Marie, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm glad we're all acknowledging we've had rough weeks. I've also had a rough week, but my highlight was seeing that Mablethorpe Primary School, shout out to Mablethorpe Primary School, went on their launch trip for the Scholars Programme to Cambridge University, and just seeing all these primary school kids from Mablethorpe in Cambridge, it made my heart sing.
Fantastic stuff. And in Faversham this morning, David Kernahan is Deputy Editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
Again, going with the consensus, it's been a rough week and I'm glad to be coming to the end of the week. And that's it. That's the highlight.
Well, there we go. Yes. So we start this week with the EOR. OFS has published new arrangements for access and participation. And DK, it's a risky business.
It is indeed. So this is yet another revamp of the access and participation planning regime from the Office to Students. It does feel like we've been doing it every month. In actual fact, this is what feels like a permanent and long-lasting change that puts access and participation planning back into the realms of the predictable, as opposed to the realms that we might need to change this next year. So, as you say, Jim, this is a risk-led approach to assessing the equality of the opportunity. The Office for Students and John Blake have come up with 12 national risks to equality of opportunity. Is defining these as instances where somebody is prevented from getting the full benefit of higher education from circumstances that are beyond their control. The idea is that providers need to take these into account when they're developing the revised access and participation plans. If that's just made you sit up in your seat, it's okay. You don't need to develop a new plan right now. There's going to be a small pilot cohort are going to be developing plans. So there's a pilot group of providers, as has been mentioned by my colleague in previous statements to the House, will start the process in the summer, and everybody else is going to start rewriting their plan in 2024. These are going to last for 4 years. They're not going to change them again for those 4 years. They're going to stay the same, although you can vary them if you would like to. So this puts the idea of access and participation onto a risk-based approach. It's a move back from the tick box, are you addressing these issues, no, yes, kind of thing that we've seen previously. And we are interested to see a refreshed access and participation dashboard. That's all the data that underpins the development of the risk register. It now includes information on completion. We can see from that for the most recent cohort available, which is, of course, the 2017-18 cohort, just 81.6% of students from the most deprived background, that I believe is ABC's Quintile 1, actually completed their course, which suggests in terms of access and participation, there is still a lot of work to do.
Interesting stuff. Now, James, you know, you will recall, I think, the kind of origins of this, which originally were really all about take some of your extra fee income and chuck it at low-income students. And then we had kind of one-year plans, and now there are these four-year plans. But in a really volatile and uncertain world, do kind of four-year plans kind of really work as a way of doing access and participation?
I rather like this. I think it's evidence-based and it allows us to prioritise. I think it's got to be at least 4 years so that you can get some kind of evidence. I think there's some questions about how much evidence you'll be able to get in that first four-year period, given the interventions, you know, will often start in secondary school. But I think this is an approach that allows us to focus. I think there's some questions. I suppose in particular, when I look at I'm new into the sector, it feels like the plans were very holistic and very ambitious last time. Whereas I think this time we would like to do something where we focus and we know the really important things to change and set some achievable targets, but then there's more accountability for delivery against those targets. At the moment, the accountability seems to be nearly entirely around the sign off of the plans. There's also a punchy, typical John Blake article as part of the press release where he's sort of saying that we shouldn't be complacent about or tolerate students from poorer backgrounds not having the same kind of continuation levels, which I think is a good challenge. It does really raise the cost of living crisis and the fact that students haven't got any more support, really, if we're from the government. And I think across the sector, we're starting to see that that's starting to impact on continuation across the board, you'd imagine, particularly for poorer students. And so if we're going to really focus on continuation, we've got to focus on that. We've got to have a better approach to cost of living right now, and we've got to look at reforming the system and bringing back grants and making it more generous in the future.
Yes, but I mean, that's a really interesting question, isn't it, Anne-Marie? You know, should a provider, when making a kind of four-year plan, should a provider be assuming that there'll be a Labour government? Should a provider assume that said Labour government will increase maintenance loans? I mean, there's a big component here, isn't there, that kind of impacts a provider's ability to hit whatever targets it sets that is kind of somewhere else but needs predicting.
Yeah, I mean, we know there's lots of potential scenarios over the next few years in terms of, you know, different Labour government, Labour, Conservative, whoever it might be, but also that we might see some changes to how the higher education system is funded and viewed and developed. I mean, for me, if you're an institution, you know, the access and participation plan is your regulatory submission. Actually, aside from that, you should have an institutional articulation of what you want to do around access and participation that stands independent of what government says. This is about way more than, you know, the regulatory requirement and the risk register. It's about, you know, what you stand for as an institution. So for me, if I was still in a higher education, I'd be putting myself at a higher education institution. I'd be putting myself up as one of the tributes in the first tranche and really getting ahead of the curve. I think the four-year timeframe is pretty decent. I'm really pleased there's a bit of flex in there and the opportunity to sort of revise the plans. You know, school improvement plans work on a one-year basis. So it's always interesting comparing the two sectors between schools and HEIs. So it's great to have a longer timeframe. I'm really pleased there's that flexibility to respond to what's going on in the broader education system. I think the APPs, you know, we're currently working in, they haven't aged well during the COVID years. And so it's really nice to see that built into the regulatory environment. I was at the event launching this yesterday, actually. And I think, you know, the risk register is a real tying together of that OFS sort of dual priority around access and standards. So, you know, you've got buckets of different risks into access, lots are in outcomes, and then just one in progression.
Interesting. Yeah, yes, DK. I mean, you know, the risk register, we'd sort of read about it and we'd heard John Blake go on about it quite a bit, but actually kind of seeing it is really interesting, isn't it? What are your reflections on whether it kind of works as a kind of overall sort of, you know, approach?
Well, I mean, I'm old school on my risk registers. I like to think alongside the risk itself, I like to think about the likelihood of the risk, the severity of the risk and the mitigations. So although we get the 12 national risks, an example might be students may not have an equal opportunity to access a sufficiently wide variety of higher education course types Alongside that, we get an unordered list of groups of students with particular characteristics that might be more likely to be subject to that risk than other students. What we don't get is any calculus on how much more likely, which is slightly frustrating as we know the data is in there and we can get to it through the various OFS dashboards. The risks overall, they seem sensible. They seem like where they should be. There's no big surprises in any of the groups. If you are an estranged student or a care leaver, you're probably going to be subject to quite a lot of these risks. If you are your traditional white male 18-year-old with 3 good A-levels from a good school, you might not be subject to any of these risks in aggregate. Of course, the other problem with this is we are still thinking in aggregate. We're not at the level where the Social Mobility Commission might like to see the idea of dealing with the individual student and their individual circumstances. There does need to be a trade-off. We obviously can't deal with every single individual student individually. We don't have the capacity, we don't have the staff, we don't have the reams of personal data that we might need to be able to do that. But as it stands, we've got 12 decent risks here, and I think this is a good starting point for the planning that will follow.
I agree all of that. I think we can do some of that at the institutional level, the more bespoke stuff that you're talking about, DK. And I completely agree with Anne-Marie that institutions, you know, you take the regulation, but then you put your plan forward and hold yourself accountable. But I think if we're going to try and argue for more funding over the next few years, we need to be able to show that this is sticking across the whole sector. And so it is just down to institutions sort of talking about how they've performed. I'm not sure we will get to where we want to get to or have confidence that we're going to get there from our stakeholders.
Yes, and as well as that kind of across the sector thing, James. So, you know, I mean, one of the things that John Blake talks about is this idea of kind of, you know, deleting the cheat codes where this kind of stuff actually kind of runs through the DNA of a university. And, you know, I mean, there are clearly some universities where senior managers think their job is to kind of protect their academics from OFS rather than, you know, kind of embed some of the principles. But, I mean, and how does this kind of work? You know, are you intending that, you know, if John Blake rocked up one morning to Chelsea College of Arts, then, you know, the academics that are knocking around that building would be kind of living and breathing their bit of the APP? Is that, you know, I mean, how do you do it in a large institution like yours?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, we sort of focus on the targets where we feel we're furthest behind, and we put them in our, call it, institution-wide targets. And then there's some fairly specific things that you can do around putting flags around particular students when they're coming in to apply, although there's some limits on that. We are working with contextual admissions, but I think we've had a bit of a voluntary approach. I think we're now going to go to a bit more of a mandated one. And then with the awarding gaps or attainment gaps, we worked through those at course level, and we had made some quite good progress on that, but we've now stalled. So we've put in place a kind of plan for the next 3 years where we're going to do a bit of a mini John Blake, which is go and look at the evidence of what's working and what's not, so that we can, maybe without his chutzpah and rhetorical verve, but go and look at what's working and what's not, and stop what's not working, and systematize what is.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, Anne-Marie, one other question. Obviously, the dashboards have come out this week, and, you know, in reality, in a lot of areas, you know, some of the kind of gaps have got worse. You know, some of the progress has gone into reverse on all sorts of aspects of both getting in and getting on. And when we kind of spoke to John Blake the day before the launch, he was saying, you know, I mean, clearly egregious missing of the previous targets, the kind of Chris Millwood targets, would result in the usual OFS-style interventions. But, you know, long, protracted conversations with every provider about whether it was the pandemic and the cost of living crisis or not wouldn't be productive. What's your sense of whether or not people really should be still be having their feet held to the fire on the old plans?
Because, you know, if not, then it's like Bobby Ewing in the Shell. We just forget the last 4 or 5 years, don't we?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, whenever you've got a strategy, and essentially that's what an access and participation plan is, right? It's an institutional strategy about how you're going to help students from different backgrounds. I think it's really important to round that off and measure yourself against what you set out to do, regardless of what the headwinds were from COVID or other factors. So I do think it's important that we have that process of concluding the current access and participation plans, not least because there's valuable learning in terms of what we do next with these new APPs. There is a distinct shift though, right, from those Chris Millward targets. And, you know, yesterday, Robert Halfen was saying, you know, we want to move away from previous static targets. And John Blake was saying, we will take providers at their word. So we're seeing a sort of maturation, I think, of the relationship between APPs and universities and the regulator. I tell you what, I am really pleased to see back in the mix, though, and I've said this for years, the consultation document and the analysis of consultation responses, I really do recommend folks have a look at it because it gives you a good sense of where the sector is in terms of the APP plans. I'm really pleased that it's gone back in, that institutions will need to clearly state their cash investment into this area of work. Because we know one of the things in the last round of APPs was, you know, COVID hit, funds were repurposed. It's really important that the resources line up in terms of the scale of the challenge for some of those groups that you mentioned, Jim. The other thing that's really fantastic in terms of the consultation is, you know, I think OFS have clearly listened, and you can get that. They've changed some of their plans on APPs. I was super pleased to see around the evaluation piece and support for publishing both things that are positive in terms of outcomes and the learning that, you know, this didn't work or this hasn't had an impact, or even worse than that, this has had a negative impact on students, because that for me is the watershed moment where we can really start to dial up progress. So I'm really pleased to see cash investment and, you know, evaluation, no matter how beautiful it is, being published. I think those two things are game changers.
It's a reminder this all costs money. So we're really happy to see that they've agreed to let us cost out the cost of doing this. But it does show that this will cost money across the sector. And with a frozen fee, there'll be pressure on all of these budgets. So if we can show that it's sticking across the sector, there's evidence of why it's working, that will help make the case for investment in the fee.
Just before we move off this, DK, there was a line in there that I thought was, my eyebrow went up. there's a line in there that says, set out what your investment is going to be. By the way, if you want to recruit, we still expect you to spend what you said you were going to spend. And I was thinking, hello, that sounds problematic given some of the very wild, significant changes we've seen to size and shape at the moment.
I think this idea comes from a world where the student premium funding existed and was something that we could use to support students that required extra support in terms of academic activity, settling in, all the other stuff. At the moment, what used to be the student premium funding has pretty much turned by default into the magic money tweak. It's the resources that we are told that providers are allowed to devote entirely to student hardship funds, because of the biggest risk of them all, as Jim spotted on the site, that the government fails to do anything about student maintenance funding, and even more students end up struggling financially. I think it's probably too much to hope that an Office for Students plan would have an understanding and a tackling of that particular risk in it. But I think it's something that's going to be very real for a lot of providers, that they haven't got the money to do the access and participation work as well as they might like. And students haven't got the money to support them actually study on the courses that they've got into.
Good. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, my name is Jacqueline Baxter from the Open University Business School, and today I'm going to be writing about why an identity clash means we often lose good practitioners who come into academia. It's a very important topic because many universities employ good practitioners to teach on vocational courses such as business, social work, nursing or teaching. But when they come into the profession, There are a number of reasons why they may feel uncomfortable and why their professional identities might not start to form as effectively as they might. This article looks at that and tries to seek a way that we can help these practitioners more effectively make the transition from practice to academia.
Now, next up, UCAS has been looking to the future and Anne-Marie, they're predicting a million.
Yes, Jim. So this week, UCAS have released their Journey to a Million publication, and this is modelling that essentially looks at undergraduate application levels across the rest of this decade. It assumes that if demand remains and government policy remains favourable, that we will hit 1 million applicants by 2030. Actually, we see a demographic dip after that, and then numbers return to current levels by 2040. So there's a few scenarios in their modelling, but it's really to start the conversation about how would we respond to this tsunami of demand that is coming over the next few years.
I think we're confident we can do this. I think we need a plan from the government. In a previous life, I was involved with setting the 50% target when I worked in government, and one of the advantages of that was it started the conversation from there's going to be 50%. What does that mean in terms of funding and planning? So I think if we could go have that kind of forward plan where government works out overall, with all the stakeholders in the sector, what needs to be put in place at the macro level to make that happen, I think then universities would need a plan. And I think we need bigger universities. You know, I think quality at scale, as UCAS are saying in their sort of thought pieces, that's something that can be done, happens all around the world, and we can do here. So we can get more students into our existing universities. We need flexible modes of learning, online, low residency. There's something slightly funny about how, on the one hand, the government likes the LLE, on the other hand, less keen on online. I think if I were them, I would think online should be a really big part of lifelong learning, getting people who haven't had a chance to learn to come to university. So I think that's a big part of it. And then we need fairer funding to get more people to be able to come, just as we were discussing just now.
Right. Yeah, there is so much controversy about the sheer physical capacity of the sector to take on these extra students, these extra 18-year-olds that we know are going to be there because we can see them in ONS projections, and the extra international students, which, if we look at existing trends, it seems kind of very unlikely that they're going to stop anytime soon. In every other sphere of education, we see capacity planning as a part of what central governments end up doing. If there is a baby boom, we need more schools, we build more schools, or we set up more free schools or whatever else. At the moment, there's a lot of investment in building up your 16 to 19 provision, because that's where the big bump up of young people in England is. We have not seen the systemic investment in the capacity of the sector as infrastructure. If you think of the sector as kind of a skills infrastructure that meets the skills needs of the country and meets the needs of those people who are entering the job market to make sure they've got the skills they need to do what they want to do. If you see higher education, tertiary education, as being that infrastructure, it is dangerously over capacity. We are going to see, unless we see some change either in the funding model or in the way we think about universities more generally, we are going to see dips in quality because of the fee freeze. We are going to see dips in the student experience because of capacity, because of accommodation, because of as I think it's actually yourself, Jim, who keeps saying, the lack of places on campus to sit quietly on a Tuesday afternoon and do some work. The sector is not currently big enough to deal with a million applicants a year. The government needs to make the decision, do we want a million applicants a year? And do we want to deal with the political fallout that means properly investing in expansion and resourcing so that they have a good and worthwhile experience? Or do we want to not have a million applicants a year and deal with the issue that you are artificially restricting the aspirations of young people and the aspirations that families and friends have got for young people. It's a very, very difficult moment, and the government, which has not yet shown any signs of making any big decisions as regards higher education, to actually make a big decision. I mean, to me, this is a need for something like an expert review or a royal commission or something like that. We were at that level.
Interesting, interesting. Anne-Marie, I mean, as well as all of this stuff about, you know, the size of the pie and whether you, how you should slice it, I keep telling people this. I was in Morecambe the other week, and I was thinking, you know, I've been in Falmouth a couple of months ago, and I was thinking, if I compare Morecambe and Falmouth, I mean, I know they're at different ends of the country, but obviously one has got a kind of giant university in it that sort of takes over when it's not tourist season and, you know, is really kind of economically regenerating that area. And then Morecambe looks pretty tired. And, you know, should we have an ambition to sort of Radio 1 roadshow up higher education in the future and take higher education into lots of places that it isn't at the moment in a big way? Or should we be thinking about, you know, the kind of model we've got now, only people perhaps coming to campus less or kind of operating remotely, or a bit of both? I mean, I don't know. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as James said, you know, online is one of the options for responding to the demand. But the other option is that we deliver higher education in a greater variety of places. Brilliant example of this is University of Essex delivering in Southend, and there are countless other examples. I really do think that model is worth exploring, because number one on many towns and new city, shout out Doncaster, wish list is to have a university, right? So there's all sorts of benefits here. So, you know, I think DK is right. The sort of conversation about the planned expansion in numbers is important, because I remember the student number uncapping in 2015 and how some of that played out. But I think, you know, James may have more interesting thoughts on this than me, but these 18-year-olds, even if they don't go to university, they still have to live somewhere, okay, right? So, like, they live in university halls maybe, or, you know, they live at home, but, like, there's a broader issue here about how we're going to house people beyond higher education, because they need somewhere to live.
Yes, yes. Where we house young adults in general is a massive issue for society at the moment,
exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah. And James, that is no more true. That's certainly true in London.
And that's particularly true in London. I mean, it's a pressure, different types of pressures all around the country. But, you know, I totally agree with Anne-Marie. And, you know, the way that we solve the housing crisis is by being a prosperous country, and universities help with that. International students help with that. And it's not like young people aren't going to need to live somewhere if they aren't moving to a university. I think online having different locations can help, but I think DK's suggestion about some kind of commission, some kind of way of trying to build consensus, would be absolutely brilliant. Is it going to happen? I don't know if I hold out a huge amount of hope for that. But the good thing about it happening is these things could all be thought of in the round, because what we can't do is say we're not going to meet young people's aspirations. You know, one of the striking things in the UCAS work is how much Level 3 attainment has gone up. Would we then suddenly be comfortable saying to a generation of students, your predecessors and your successors might be able to get into university, but because of a population bulge, it's going to be harder for you? I think that's not a message that any of us or any politician should feel comfortable saying.
Good. Now, next this week, a Senate committee has a new report out on mental health, James.
Yes, Wales's Children, Young People and Education Committee has been conducting a really wide-ranging inquiry, 150 pages into student mental health support, and they've just published their 33 recommendations. I suppose their central recommendation is that there should be a common framework for mental health across higher education in Wales. It's got some really good specific suggestions. For example, one thing that I think universities struggle with is students and their GP registration, so, you know, not being registered where they're at university, and therefore it being harder to access mental health services, their data not being shared. So they float the idea of a single online registration system for Wales, which is interesting. I particularly like the fact they remembered international students and their specific and similar mental health needs as well. I think Michael von Wonky called it an exemplary review, but he did worry about where the resources were going to come from to fund their ambition.
Yes. I mean, look, DK, I mean, in terms of the report itself, you know, I mean, as you know, I'm no longer timed at education shit. It never seems to look at student finance. But I mean, the other thing I was thinking when I was reading this report was, Education Committee never looks at student mental health either. And it's not like student mental health hasn't been a big issue for the past 4 or 5 years. What? How is the Welsh parliamentary system getting this right when we don't seem to be able to ever have a proper focus on students or the student experience in for the English system?
Well, on a really practical level, the Welsh parliamentary system was designed to offer scrutiny and analysis. The parliamentary system in Westminster, I think it's fair to say, was accreted over a number of years. There are lots of ways in which the devolved parliaments work better as parliaments and as engines of legislation than Westminster. But this probably isn't a topic for the Wonky podcast. But if you'd like to tune into my podcast on parliamentary process, that's coming soon. In terms of the way in which this is different from England, the committee that released this report have got largely their own mind. They can choose to review anything that they fancy doing and make recommendations based on anything they fancy doing. In this case, they're pretty close to the wishes of the minister. They don't have to be. The spirit of committees in Wales is a lot less, it's a lot less partisan. There's not a sense of, oh, you're Plaid, so you would say that, or you're Conservative, you would say that. It's a lot more collaborative. This means, as we see in this report, that they've got the opportunity to think about the larger cross-cutting issues that don't perhaps neatly fit into a departmental purview, that aren't, strictly speaking, an education issue or a community health issue or an issue about the wider way that we live, work and love in a modern society. So it's been able to look across the whole gamut of every aspect of the way that the decisions of a government, in which case the Welsh government, can affect mental health among young people and students. I think this is strikingly exemplified by my favourite bit of the report and the recommendations. The idea is they're going to collect a lot more data. And in order to collect data about something as delicate and personal as student mental health, they need to be really trusting of their regulator. I mean, both in terms of data protection and in terms of the regulator isn't suddenly going to turn around and penalise them because they've got too many students with mental health problems. If you compare that to the approach in the National Student Survey, the new question on mental health is, how well communicated with information about your university or college's mental well-being support services, which doesn't really tell us anything apart from about the ability of your SU to put posters up in the toilet next to the condom machine. So I think that the idea that the Welsh Government Committee are aware there is more data that it is useful to collect, and is suggesting that the regulator will be able to collect this in a way that is not punitive, that is sensitive to student needs and student requirements, and can help plan a better mental health and mental well-being experience for students, is an utterly marvellous thing. It's a great report. I'd strongly recommend you read it.
Anne-Marie, it does strike me that if the Welsh Government accepts these recommendations, this is a real step forward in terms of, you know, ending that, at the risk of sounding clichéd, ending that kind of postcode lottery of, you know, not knowing that you're at least going to get a minimum level of support in each provider.
Yeah, I think that's amazing, right? A common experience and a promise to students of what they can expect, not just from universities, but also from other sectors like the NHS. And for me, that's the really standout thing about the inquiry and also the recommendations, that it's taking that cross-sector view. you know, the future is a link up between health and education. And we know those two things can accelerate each other in both very good ways and very, very bad ways as well. And so for me, that's the real highlight of this report. It does make particular note of the Cardiff Mental Health University Liaison Scheme, where NHS staff are embedded in universities. You know, schools have been doing this for a wee while, actually, you know, embedding folks like paediatricians into schools. I just think this is ingenious. It's exactly how the systems need to be working together, bridging that gap between, you know, the health system and the education system. And so I echo whatever, you know, whatever else has been said. Sorry, I don't know what's just happened there. I echo other people's thoughts that this is, you know, a really holistic report and quite a serious step change in terms of the discussion about the mental health of students, but also what we can do about that to create a better experience for students. So, yeah, a bit of a watershed moment, maybe.
James, there's an opportunity here, isn't there? Because, you know, to the extent to which we know that good health means that students are much more likely to succeed, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand with good education. The kind of really simplistic version of this is, you know, someone ought to talk to Wes Streeting about, you know, his interest in education and the fact that he will probably be the education secretary after the next election. But more broadly, there are opportunities here, aren't there, for a kind of integrated approach. Perhaps, I don't know, I mean, certainly in London, that's got to be a prize worth trying to grab.
I mean, I think this is something where there's political consensus. I think all parties are interested in this, so we should be hopeful. I think there's a similar pilot being tried in Manchester with, I think, Edward Peck and others have been working to get health professionals into universities there. So yeah, the similar approach has been tried in all the devolved administrations. So I think, yeah, some local leadership would be helpful, not least because, you know, ideally we'd also like to have data sharing with schools. If someone's had a really good package of support going through their school, then having that as something that we could work with before the student comes to us would be super helpful. I suppose one different thought is, it is great how out in the open this is now. You know, when I was at university, I was off the rails and struggling for a bit, and I got some counselling support. I would never dream to tell anyone about it. I'm not sure I told my mum about it. So the fact that people are so, you know, whether on buses going around Europe or, you know, just their day-to-day, this has now become something which is not completely out in the open, because I think there are some struggles. I think some international students in particular, it's more taboo, but we have, you know, I think it is genuinely a bigger problem than it was, but I think the solutions are better than they were. The fundamental thing we've got to sort out is the pressure on the NHS. You know, it's really, really hard to get the right support to students once it becomes a real crisis. And universities have got a big role, but we can't replace what the health system needs to do.
Unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably not missed the global conversation about generative AI. Universities and students are now part of a massive experiment in artificial intelligence and its integrations across our lives, particularly in education, productivity, research, and creativity. Institutions, regulators, and governments were caught off guard and are now catching up. Fascinating conversations have opened up inside the sector about the future for assessment, the consequences for teaching and research, the curriculum for running universities, and more. So join us on 19th of April for an online event where we'll be delving in to some of these debates and bringing them out into the open to help you and us catch up. And if you don't know your mid-journey from your stable diffusion, then don't worry, this is not an event about the tech, but about how universities think, plan, and organise themselves in the era of AI. And if you work in a university, we think you'll find it useful. So, that's The Avalanche is here, online, 19th of April. Book your tickets now at wonky.com/events. And remember, don't panic.
Now, finally this week, Turnitin is releasing a new tool to detect generative AI, but people seem to want to turn it off, DK.
ChatGPT and similar large language models are a thing, and the sector is losing its collective brilliant mind at what to do about it. Obviously, when we turn to issues of academic integrity, examination, working out which students pass and which students fail. This is really important stuff. So we turn to technology, obviously. Rather than doing any serious thinking about assessment. And Turnitin, who presented about 20 years ago the solution to academic plagiarism that is so effective that there is now no more plagiarism in the entire of the higher education system, has got an equally worthwhile approach to detecting AI materials. The idea is it works via the raw power of statistics. So large language models work by coming up with the most likely sequence of words that would answer a question based on a deep reading of the entire internet and all kinds of other data sources that we don't actually know about. Turnitin works almost in the same way. It's got a large corpus of materials, largely the intellectual property of the students and providers that submitted them as assessed work. And they are also able to spot the most predictable, I guess, answer for each question. So the way this tool works is to say, is this the most predictable answer to the question? If so, it's possible it might be an AI. This works separately to the plagiarism detection scheme. It's a different set of lights that light up. Because this is such a new technology, nobody really knows how it's going to be, how it's actually going to work in real life yet. But a lot of universities have thought, you know, we're not sure about this approach to detection. We're not sure we actually want this in front of our markers. So they petitioned for and successfully got the ability to turn the indications off. And that's where we are.
James, the kind of short-term cheating stuff is what it is. But these are really big challenges, aren't they, in terms of kind of, you know, the labour market, purpose of HE, curriculum. You know, there must at least be some bits of, you know, Arts London that are kind of feeling vaguely nervous at this point.
Yes, I think there's a short-term thing, which is if we have said with an essay or a piece of work, we expect it to be your own work, then if you plagiarize or use generative AI, then that is cheating, and we've made that clear. We put out some guidance to that effect. So that's the sort of short-term, relatively easy bit of it. I think the next bit we need to take our time over, because it raises some really exciting but also challenging questions. You know, people will be using these technologies in their the work that they go on to do after being here. So we need to think about what that means for how we teach. I don't think it's a new category of problem. You know, we don't say to people, you can't use animation software, you can't use graphic communication software, you've all got to do it with pencil. But we do make people do it with pencil as well. So we want people to have the options. We do use essays. Actually, quite often there's a perception that in an art school, it's mostly going to be, you know, the project and the dress or the sculpture. But we very much teach both. It's both the skills, but also the creative thinking, reflecting back on, you know, your process and how it fits into the history of your subject. And so it's definitely something that there's a threat for us. But I think in the long term, it's going to be much more of an opportunity than a threat. We need to deal with the short term issues, but then we need to think about what it's going to mean for our pedagogy and the jobs that people go into, and undoubtedly the courses we offer.
Anne-Marie, it's funny. I mean, when we were on our, you know, one of our bus tours this year, actually, when we were in Belgium, we came across a student who was actually quite edgy, because he'd got an exam that afternoon, and it turned out it was an oral exam, and somehow he was able to, his department was able to kind of scale that. Is that part of the answer, do you think? You know, this that sense that, you know, we might have to start doing kind of mini vivas.
Yeah, you know, I definitely think, oral and spoken examinations could be part of the solution. And you're right, schools have been well ahead of the curve. You know, the charity Oracy 21 has been working with hundreds of schools across the UK to see Oracy as a key skill alongside, you know, reading, writing and arithmetic. And also, you know, that sort of assessment that that student in Brussels is talking about, really common in language degrees, for example. You know, I certainly had that in my degree studying a bit of French. But also some universities already offer, you know, grade composition on things like seminar participation. I have to say, I would have loved that sort of examination. You know, I, as the sort of student who was getting like 90 plus on my spoken contributions and then, you know, a sort of middling 2-1 for my essays at first if I was lucky. So I actually do think that that is a sort of healthy rebalancing and potentially part of the solution to the challenges we've got here.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to James, Anne-Marie, DK, our news editor Michael Salmon, who helps make the show happen. Mark will be here after Easter. Until then, stay wonky.